This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden expresses his government's support for Ukraine in its dispute with Russia. There are more indications that chemical weapons have been used in the Syrian civil war. Thai authorities foil a plot against Israeli tourists. And we celebrate Earth Day with a look at a French filmmaker. It's all ahead on International Edition. Sitting in today for Susan Yaki, I'm Dave DeForest. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has told Ukrainian leaders that the United States will stand with them in the face of what he calls humiliating threats. Biden is in Kiev meeting with active President Oleksandr Turchynov and interim Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk as the tension in eastern Ukraine shows no sign of cooling off. Biden said the new Ukrainian government has an opportunity to create a united country, but he warned the Ukrainians that they first must fight what he says is the cancer of corruption. Biden also said the United States is ready to help Ukraine become energy independent and not have to rely on Russian natural gas. Meanwhile, VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports a weekend agreement to avert wider conflict in Ukraine is faltering, with pro-Moscow separatist gunmen showing no sign of backing down.
U.S. officials say the vice president's in Kiev to boost economic and political assistance to authorities there, while making clear to Russia that it will face mounting costs if it chooses continuing destabilization over a more constructive course. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki.
We hope to see a de-escalation in the coming over the next few days. And if there's not progress, we remain prepared, along with our European and G7 partners, to impose additional costs. So there'll need to be decisions made in a matter of days.
But Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says it's the United States that needs to act more responsibly in Ukraine.
Before giving us ultimatums and demanding from us to do something in 2 or 3 days and threatening sanctions if that doesn't happen, we would firmly urge our American partners to take their full responsibility for those whom they brought to power and whom they now try to defend, turning a blind eye to atrocities committed by this regime.
Pro-Russian militants in some eastern and southern provinces are calling for Russian troops to protect them from the government in Kiev, as both sides accuse the other of breaking a peace agreement reached just last week. Russia says the Ukrainian militants occupying government buildings are operating independently of Moscow. But American University professor Keith Darden says Russia could clearly be doing more to help end the standoff.
If there was a very strong statement from Moscow saying these groups need to disarm, you need to leave those government buildings, we do not support you, that would have a profound effect on the facts on the ground. Nothing like that is happening.
Lavrov says attempts to isolate Russia over Ukraine are hopeless because it's impossible to isolate Russia. However, Darden believes the sanctions are working.
Their primary effect is in generating uncertainty. And uncertainty spooks investors. And you've seen a lot of capital fly out of Russia in the last months. I think if there are new sanctions, even if they're limited in terms of the number of individuals or companies targeted, it's going to continue to raise the prospect that, you know, any business transaction with the Russian Federation is going to be sanctioned.
Darden says the most important thing Biden can do in Kiev is try to persuade authorities to start talks on constitutional reforms with representatives from the South and from the East so as to lower tensions before the start of elections next month. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev has told lawmakers the country can weather the sanctions imposed by the West over the situation in Ukraine. In a televised speech to the Russian parliament today, Mr. Medvedev said he will not let Russian citizens become hostage to what he called political games and unfriendly actions. The prime minister said he is confident his government will be able to minimize the consequences of sanctions and that it will act under what he calls new conditions. He assured lawmakers that Russian industries that rely on support from other markets would get help from the government. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
U.S. officials say they have indications toxic chemicals were used in a rebel area of Syria this month. White House spokesman Jay Carney said Monday the alleged attack in the western village of Kafr Zeta involved an industrial chemical that was probably chlorine. Meanwhile, the United Nations is expressing concern about Syria's plans to hold a presidential election on June 3rd. A spokesman for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told reporters Monday the vote goes against an international outline for bringing a political solution in Syria. Edward Uranian looks at Syria's plans for an election.
The announcement that the Syrian government would go ahead with presidential elections coincided with the sound of warplanes over the capital and violence in and around all five of Syria's major cities. Parliament Speaker Jihad al-Laham made the long-awaited announcement despite skepticism from many that it would be possible to hold an election amid raging battles across much of the country.
لأحكام دستور الجمهورية العربية السورية وأحكام قانون الانتخابات العامة رقم 5
says in accordance with the Syrian constitution and the 2014 electoral law, he is calling on Syrian citizens both inside and outside the country to exercise their right to elect the president of the Syrian Republic. He stresses that those who would like to run for president have until May 1st to present their candidacies to the Supreme Court. Laham's announcement was greeted with rounds of Katyusha rockets fired by rebel fighters outside the capital, Damascus. The Syrian government news agency Sana reported that five people were killed by rocket fire around the parliament building and the health ministry. A spokesman for the Free Syrian Army told Al Arabiya TV that the rocket fire was aimed at the parliament and the nearby Syrian Army Officers Club. He added that it was possible that civilian targets were accidentally hit by the rockets. Syria scholar Joshua Landis, who heads the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, says the announcement of the election, given the current circumstance, is almost ironic.
We used to laugh at elections won by 99%. Today you just have to cry. It would be laughable if it weren't so tragic.
A former U.S. ambassador to Syria, Richard Murphy, tells VOA that it is predictable that Bashar al-Assad would present himself as a presidential candidate. And he says it is even more predictable that he will easily win this election. Murphy says that is because the opposition is fragmented and is unlikely to support a single candidate. Plus, with so many Syrians internally displaced or taking refuge in other countries, it will be hard to get an accurate vote count. He adds, the Assads don't lose elections. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Thai authorities say they hope they have foiled the latest plot in the Southeast Asian country to attack young Israeli tourists. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
Thailand's police agency says security around locations frequented by Israeli tourists has been increased, although government officials deny published reports that as many as nine people linked to the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah may still be at large in the country. A spokesman for the Royal Thai Police, Major General Pia Utayo, says security has been enhanced not only in Bangkok but throughout the country. Thai authorities say they hope they have disrupted plans for one or more attacks targeting Israelis by taking into custody two suspects. The pair, natives of Lebanon, allegedly has ties to Hezbollah, considered by the United States and Israel to be a terrorist organization. The arrested Lebanese men are identified as Daoud Farhat, who also holds French citizenship, and Youssef Ayad, who has a Philippines passport. The Director General of the Thai Foreign Ministry's Information Department, Sek Wanamete, tells VOA News the two are being held on violating terms of their tourist visas, but they have not been charged with any more serious offenses at this time.
Material were found which could be linked to violent means. But on the Thai side, we cannot conclude that they are here to operate any terrorist activities. But the Thai authorities, immigration office, have decided to revoke their visa, so we have to go through the procedures by using the Immigration Act.
A third suspect Thai authorities were alerted to by Israeli officials did not enter the country, according to officials here. Published reports say information provided by Israel outlined plans to launch attacks at six locations in the Thai capital. Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs declined to release any details. A spokesman says the Israeli government is confident the Thai authorities are taking whatever steps necessary. The attacks, according to Thai officials, would have taken place last week during the Thai New Year's festival, which coincided with the Jewish holiday of Passover. Media reports say some of the attacks were to target Bangkok's Khaosan Road, where young backpackers, notably Israelis, tend to congregate. A senior research fellow at Israel's Institute for National Security Studies, Yoram Schweitzer, says Hezbollah has a sophisticated operations unit outside its base in Lebanon and has repeatedly tried to carry out attacks in Thailand as well as other countries.
In the last 2 years, they have tried extensively to do it abroad, not only in Bangkok, in Turkey, in India, in Azerbaijan, and in Bangkok itself. They tried to do something like this in 2012, and we had the operation even in 96 that was foiled due to an accident. So they have these capabilities, they have these intentions, and it's definitely not surprising.
Thai Foreign Ministry spokesman Sek says authorities in Bangkok are aware of this and intend to foil any future attempts.
Thai security agencies remain vigilant. They work closely with all security units, particularly with Israeli and with other countries, because the fact that Thailand is a destination for tourists and it's an aviation hub in Southeast Asia, that is one of the downsides of being an aviation hub.
Thailand is a popular budget destination and jumping-off point to other nearby countries for young Israelis after completing their compulsory military service. It is estimated that about 120,000 Israelis visit Thailand annually. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Somali militants have claimed responsibility for killing a second member of parliament in as many days. Al-Shabaab says it shot Abdiaziz Isaac Musal. He died today after an ambush in the Medina district of Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab is threatening to continue its attacks on lawmakers. Rebels in South Sudan have denied UN accusations that they killed hundreds of people after taking control of a small town last week. A rebel spokesman said the rebel fighters were not responsible for the killings in Bentiu and blamed others, including government forces. The UN mission in South Sudan said Monday that rebels killed more than 200 civilians and wounded more than 400 others at a local mosque where people had gone to escape the fighting. VOA's Margaret Bashir has the story from the United Nations.
The UN strongly condemned what it called targeted killings of civilians, which took place along national and ethnic lines. In a statement, the UN mission, known as UNMISS, said more than 200 civilians were reportedly killed and over 400 wounded in the Bentiu Mosque, where they had gone to flee the violence. It said fighters with the rebel force known as the SPLA in opposition separated individuals based on their ethnicities and nationalities, safely escorting some out of the mosque and killing others. Similar attacks were reported at a Catholic church, an evacuated World Food Program compound, and Bentiu Hospital. Sudanese of Darfuri ethnicity were also targeted. The UN also condemned the use of the local radio station by rebels to incite killings and rape. UN peacekeeping spokesman Nick Birnbach told VOA that UNMISS has deployed additional peacekeepers from its 8,000-plus strong force to Bentiu and other locations where attacks have been reported.
But the truth of the matter is that we can't be everywhere at all times. Also, our peacekeepers are focusing on the protection of civilian sites, where we are sheltering thousands and thousands of terrified IDPs who are fleeing the violence and who are depending on us for their security.
Last week, peacekeepers helped get hundreds of civilians in threatened areas in Bentiu and Rubkona to their base for protection. The base is now refuge for more than 22,000 people. The UN's Birnbach said there is a vicious cycle of attack and counterattack happening.
Civilians are, as always, bearing the brunt of it. We're doing everything we can to work with local authorities to try to not only investigate but deter. But ultimately, it is the authorities in South Sudan who are going to have to take action to stop these terrible events from continuing to occur.
Fighting erupted in South Sudan in December as the army of President Salva Kiir and rebels allied with his former vice president Riek Machar began fighting each other. Violence has now displaced more than 1 million South Sudanese from their homes. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A new report says organized crime, government corruption, and militias are all linked to elephant poaching and the illegal ivory trade. We get more from VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The report is called Ivory's Curse, the militarization and professionalization of poaching in Africa. It's a joint effort by the conservation group Born Free USA and C4ADS, a nonprofit organization that analyzes the drivers of conflict and insecurity. Adam Roberts is Born Free USA Chief Executive Officer.
For years, Born Free USA and other animal advocates have campaigned against the trade in elephant ivory, but on conservation and animal welfare concerns. And we wanted to find a little bit more detail about who was behind the ivory trade. It's not just enough to say it's criminal syndicates, nefarious profiteers. We wanted to know who was really behind it so that we can try and get governments around the world to do more to crack down.
Robert says Born Free needed some help in gathering that kind of information.
That's one of the reasons that we commissioned C4ADS to do the report for us, because I think the breadth of our capabilities within the conservation community are pretty much limited to conservation, but having a defense analyst that looks at the militarism behind all of these poaching incidents gives them access to information that we wouldn't otherwise have.
The report provides regional case studies of the ivory trade. For example, in Sudan, the report says government-allied militias complicit in the Darfur genocide fund their operations by poaching elephants. But it goes on to say that poaching occurs hundreds of miles outside of Sudan's borders. In Somalia, the report blames the militant group Al-Shabaab and criminal networks who poach in neighboring Kenya. The weapons they use, it says, come from local security forces.
It's not going to come as a shock to anyone that Somalia is implicated in the ivory trade. And again, much like Sudan, you have these actors that are able to move cross borders from Somalia to different countries in the region. But probably the biggest part of that, though, is the inability of some of those surrounding countries, those neighboring countries, to deter the ivory trade from the people in either Sudan or Somalia because they lack the resources to do so.
The report says organized crime in Mozambique is willing to battle the South African Army and park rangers to poach rhino horn. In Gabon and the Republic of Congo, it says forest exploitation has allowed East Asian organized crime to come to the region and poach Central Africa's elephants. And Robert says Zimbabwe continues to be a poaching hotspot.
Partly what's happening with poaching in Zimbabwe is a result of the political situation where you have a regime that's been in place for so long that we feel is complicit in the ivory trade because of giving impunity to the actors involved in the ivory trade in the country, that it's very hard to get a handle on what's happening. You know, in 1997, when the international ban on trade in elephant ivory was first undermined, one of the countries that was behind that was Zimbabwe, and the meeting, the international meeting where that happened, was held in Harare.
The Born Free CEO says combating poaching requires a coordinated strategy all along the ivory trade chain. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Today is Earth Day 2014, with a focus on green cities and mobilizing millions of people to create a sustainable, healthy environment by greening communities worldwide. On the occasion of Earth Day, we have this report about French filmmaker Luc Jacquet, who won worldwide acclaim for his 2005 Academy Award-winning documentary, March of the Penguins. Now, Jacquet is back with a new film that takes moviegoers deep into the heart of a tropical rainforest, not only to celebrate its grandeur, but to make the case for its survival. VOA's Roseanne Scurble has our report.
Once Upon a Forest is a visual poem that conveys the wonder of the rainforest, says Luc Jacquet. He spent 5 months with his crew filming in majestic forests in Gabon and Peru.
Just to say once again how this forest is amazing, how they are fascinating, how they are in balance.
Jacquet teams with famed French botanist Francis Hallet to tell the story of the forest, which opens with the 75-year-old Hallet calmly drawing on his sketch pad. He's perched 70 meters up in the parasol-like crown of a Moabi tree in Gabon's Congo River Basin. Jacquet says his work on the film helped him understand for the first time what Hallet has been preaching for decades, that trees have their own way to be alive.
When you go in this kind of thinking, you discover a new universe, the universe of trees. And it's interesting because at that point, you begin to start to think that this is not the animals who are the kings of the forest. The trees are the king of the forest.
The movie captures the life story of the rainforest. Within that tale are dozens of actors, a parade of leaf-cutting ants, a fruit-eating, seed-dropping monkey, a jaguar that prowls across the screen with stealthy steps, and vines that entangle a mighty strangler fig tree to make way for another giant to take its place in the forest. Some of those events can take hundreds of years in tree time, so Jacquet speeds them up by animating Hallet's drawings and mixing them with close-up live action.
To be clear, between what I'm able to see and what I imagine.
Inside all this imagery is a world where every plant and every animal is intimately connected with one another. Trees keep this ever-growing, ever-changing family in balance.
Yeah, this is very amazing. But, you know, we start to understand the language of the trees and the language of the flowers. And we know that trees are not talking with words, they are talking with scents. And they are able to mix this sense, like words to make a text. And they are able to exchange message. They are able to modify the behavior of animals with this substance.
He says the chemicals can even affect the weather. Jacquet captures the magic of a fleeting cloud or the dazzle of sunlight streaming through a break in the canopy in exquisite detail, with sweeps across grand vistas and close-ups that travel the length of a single tree shot by remote cameras mounted on small flying drones. The filmmaker sews these scenes together to put the soul of the forest on the big screen. He says walking its hallowed grounds and following its daily ritual tap into what it means to be human.
There is something very ancient in our brain. I guess this is an idea, but I think we are deeply made to be there.
And if people can forge that bond with nature, Jacquet says, to see themselves as part of the forest and not alien to it, we are a step closer to saving the rainforest rather than becoming an agent in its demise. Once Upon a Forest is being shown worldwide at film festivals, is in commercial release in Europe, and will be seen later this year in Asia and Latin America. Roseanne Scurble, VOA News, Washington.
Well, that's it for today. Thanks for joining us on International Edition. By the way, you can get the latest breaking news 24 hours a day on our website. It's voanews.com. Why not check it out? Sitting in again today for Susan Yaki, I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Have a great day. This is Today in History. On April 22, 1889, at exactly noon, cannons were fired to signal thousands of would-be settlers to make a mad dash into the newly opened Oklahoma Territory, previously known as Indian Territory. The Oklahoma land rush was an extraordinary display of American pioneer spirit, but also a sad example of the gradual loss of Indian lands. In 1864, the U.S. Congress passed the Coinage Act that mandated that the inscription, "In God We Trust," be placed on all coins minted as United States currency. In 1876, the first National League baseball game was played in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The Boston Red Stockings defeated the Philadelphia Athletics 6-5. In 1912, Pravda, the official publication of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, was published for the first time in St. Petersburg. On this day in 1915, German forces introduced the first major use of poisonous chlorine gas along the Western battlefront during World War I. The French and British would soon retaliate in kind. On this day in 1969, at a concert in Dalton, England, the British rock band The Who debuted their rock opera about a deaf, dumb, and blind boy who becomes a pinball champion. In 1975, Tommy was made into a movie that was a huge commercial success. Then in 1993, a stage version on Broadway won 5 Tony Awards, including Best Original Score for its creator, Who guitarist Peter Townsend. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the recent U.S.-Morocco strategic dialogue, both countries expressed their commitment to a partnership to advance a stable, democratic, and prosperous Maghreb, Africa, and Middle East. Security is one of the most fundamental obligations that a government owes its citizens. Here, the United States and Morocco stand together. For a decade, the U.S. has participated in joint military exercises with Morocco. These exercises are being expanded to include other countries from Africa, Europe, and Canada. On the economic front, Morocco is one of the fewer than 20 countries in the world and the only country on the African continent where the United States has a free trade agreement. "We need to build on the strength of that investment," said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. "Morocco's incredible potential for growth and its growing role as a vital gateway to the African continent make it even more important for the United States to grow the relationship." Morocco is already among the top African countries investing in African nations. Indeed, Morocco signed 18 different agreements with Mali earlier this year in areas from microfinance to infrastructure. Morocco is driving both greater security and greater prosperity in the Maghreb. At home, Morocco has made it a priority to promote entrepreneurship. "I firmly believe," said Mr. Kerry, "that the places where citizens have the freedom to dream up a new idea and take that idea and put it into reality, those are the places where people can be their own boss and where they're free to fail. Those are the societies that are the most successful. They're the societies that are the most cohesive, and those are the places that are the most peaceful, tranquil, and satisfied." The U.S. Agency for International Development is focused on supporting this kind of pursuit of prosperity in Morocco. USAID is working in 3 areas: developing the workforce, supporting more responsive government, and improving education in those first, most critical years. The United States and Morocco share a broad set of values that will provide the foundation for even wider cooperation within the strategic dialogue in the years ahead.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.